Buddhist Summer School, Wednesday morning, 31st August 1977. Inconceivable is the reality of transcendence. It is the absolute dark. It is the absolute light. It is the void. It is the plenum. We, as we are, can never conceive of it. We may receive a flash from it, which enlightens us for a moment. But that enlightenment is just like a lightning flash, which has, for the moment, lit up the environment, and then it is gone again. But we may be left a little more open thereby to this transcendent reality. This transcendent reality is the origin of all things. It is the death of all things. It is the source and the goal, and all that lies between in time and circumstance. All this belongs to transcendence. How can we comprehend that transcendence? If we could, we ourselves would be completely at one with transcendence. But it is a oneness which we would never know. It is the unknown and the unknowable in its own supreme reality. Only a fragment can be touched by us, insofar as we ourselves, infinitesimal fragments of that transcendent reality, are fully awake, fully alive, and fully selfless, not hemmed in by the sense of separate ego. In our world in which we live, self-conscious in the isolative manner, we split up that transcendence. We cannot avoid it. We are like that. Our beginning, for we function in terms of time, our beginning is in ignorance. Our ending could be in the awakened state. And if we are fortunate enough to travel thus happily to this happy consummation, then, insofar as is possible for man as man, to realize there is realization. But it is the realization by transcendence itself, as manhood, as perfect manhood, through the individual man. This is difficult for us to grasp, because our ego-centered consciousness is so hemmed in, and it itself sets such limitations on our possibilities of being at one with transcendence, that it is very easy for us constantly to fall into the error of separating a total reality from us, ourselves, as little realities. So it is difficult to see that that which in eternity is absolute and complete in itself experiences this immense, immeasurable becoming process in totality. But we experience it in terms of time and space and change. Change, which means that there is no going back to an old state. Change, which is under the domination of our unidirectional time consciousness. We are not eternity conscious. If we were eternity conscious, truly awake to eternity, then past, present, future would have no meaning in separate terms. They would be an integrated wholeness. And if the three aspects of time did form an integrated wholeness for us, then change, sorrow, suffering, and all the duals, pleasure, pain, sorrow, joy, would vanish out of our conscious existence. So it is very difficult for us to see the full and true meaning of samsara, this becoming process, this process which we are conscious of as change, which has a beginning, a proceeding, and an ending, which means which has birth and death and all that lies in between and is tied up with it. And because we are so conscious unidirectionally and have our limited vision, our limited views, our limited ambitions and purposes and goals and striving, we are unawake to the fact that nirvana holds samsara completely and wholly within it, and also samsara holds nirvana completely and wholly within it. Because samsara and nirvana are the names we give to our limited experiencing, our dark perceptions, whilst we are still in the unawakened state. Nirvana is the name we give to the longed for goal, forgetting that the source and the goal are an identity. And if it is not a case of intellectual forgetting, it is a case of the fact that our senses function in such a manner that they superimpose, they bring into the forefront of the mind, of our conscious mind, change and differentiation, rather than the state of complete wholeness. Therefore, this one total reality, in its unitary wholeness, almost completely escapes our constant awareness. Therefore, we are not in constant communion, in constant samadhi, fully awake in that communion to the reality. Unconsciously, the fact is that the whole organism, with all its changes, all its sufferings and joys, is in constant communion. But our own brains, our own perturbed, disturbed psyche splits that up. And we are unawake to the state of communion. If we were awake, and whilst we are awake, in those magical moments in our life, to that state of communion, then there is no separation between this and that. There is only the state of the fullness which is identical with the emptiness. There is that wonderful verse which prefaces the Isha Upanishad. That is full. This is full. If from fullness is withdrawn, what remains is the fullness. There are wonderful verses like that scattered throughout the scriptures of the world. And also, in the Isha Upanishad, you will find this quite extraordinary statement. Into blind darkness enter they that worship ignorance. meaning hold worthy the things that change. Into darkness greater than that, as it were, they that delight in knowledge. Other indeed they say than knowledge. Other they say, they referring to the perfected holy ones, than non-knowledge. Thus we have heard from the wise, who to us have explained it. Knowledge and non-knowledge. He who this pair conjointly knows, with non-knowledge passing over death, with knowledge wins the immortal. Again it is repeated, into blind darkness enter they who worship non-becoming. Into darkness greater than that, as it were, they who delight in becoming. Other indeed, they say, than origin. Other, they say, than non-origin. Thus we have heard from the wise, who to us have explained it. Becoming and destruction. He who this pair conjointly knows, with destruction passing over death, with becoming wins the immortal. How extraordinary are teachings like that. What a depth of realization lies hid in verses of that sort. But let us not think that by musing upon such verses we can arrive at the full knowledge, the full awareness, the full being of that transcendent reality, the unitary wholeness of that transcendent reality is so overwhelming that in our confined state as psychophysical organisms, if it came upon us in its fullness, we would be completely crushed. We would be destroyed by the immensity of the energy that would be let loose upon the psychophysical organism. You remember how in Exodus, the Lord says to Moses, I will pass by, but it is my back only which you will see, not my face. That face is too tremendous, too powerful for even the perfected Holy One to bear. It's only the back which may give a certain sense of that overall, overriding, immeasurable, immense, total reality. And yet, if we live the life of utter simplicity, we realize that condition of purity, and we release that capacity for absorptiveness to our fullest extent, which could enable us at least to make an intellectual form, a thought form, a conceptual form, which can be a chink in our prison house, to let in the light of awareness of at least something of the nature of that one total reality in its unitary wholeness. And if that light can enter in, then our perplexities and our doubts in connection with the nature of that whole reality disappear. And the mind realizes a state of peace and calm. It realizes a sensitivity and a responsivity which saves us from being shattered by the inrush of mind in its transcendent awareness from our ordinary psychical changing processes and expressions. And then we will find these conflicts which arise when we question, what is the truth then? What is the way? And so forth. They all disappear. I think it was yesterday morning, wasn't it? Or sometime. We were talking about moving, and we're finding ourselves back again on square one. And I said, stay on square one, because all the squares of the immensity of space are all here, square one. That is the only square that there is on which you or I can stand. And if we are awake to the full significance and implications of square one on which we stand, we will find that we are standing in the immensity of space. And the total cosmos and the whole of chaos are all a oneness, which is our little square one. And that's the marvel of it. And if that is so, what is there for you or for me to go a seeking? But let it be that total space, akasha, not space, the box, the container, but this unknown space, the void which holds the fullness of all that becomes perceivable to our senses, through our senses, by the intellect, and is comprehended or apprehended at least by the intellect, by our psychical functioning. You see, conflict arises because it is so difficult for us to be awake to the fact that the self and the not-self are separate for us in our consciousness. That is the fundamental root of this destructive conflict, this painful, sorrowful conflict that goes on in our mind. But as and when the intellect at least can feel at home with the knowledge that there is no separation in reality between self and not self, then the root source of conflict disappears. The root source of conflict which raises up evil in our lives. This is the great evil in our life, that we ourselves, because we are limited by our state of ignorance, set up this separation between self and not self. The question was raised last night, if there is no self, then what are we spending our life running after? This transcendent total reality is such that there is self, and also there is no self. The wholeness can never be understood. We can't begin to understand it if we function in terms of either this or that. If we function in terms of there is self and postulate that against there is no self, have we not laid the firm foundation for conflict and perplexity? This extraordinary containment by transcendence of all duals, of all multiplicity. If once we understand, not so much understand, if once out of pure love truly take it all into ourselves, then all these innumerable questions will not arise at all. Because there is no ground for such questions to arise. You see, the empirical self here, this psychophysical organism which goes by our own name, is an identifiable entity. It undergoes change from the moment of conception in the mother's womb until death begins the complete disintegration of all the constituents of this psychophysical organism. So until then, there is, for all practical purposes, this existential, empirical being we call the self. And this self lives and functions in a limited context. The most concrete aspect of this limited context is the living body itself. This is the most concrete expression of self. And this self interacting with the particular environment in which it is situated is the context, the larger context, the slightly larger context in which our life is spent. And it is spent in constant interaction and constant interrelationship with that environment. But if you think of this environment, and if in the depths of your heart particularly, and through the use of your intellectual perceptions, you begin to expand that context, let it expand, you will find that it will expand to the confines of the manifested universe. And you will also discover that the manifested universe, which we call a cosmos, is completely interrelated with the unmanifested. I can't say universe, but just the unmanifested, which we may call chaos, using the word chaos in its primordial meaning, not its secondary meaning of disorder. But what I can only describe in words as vibrant quiescence. If you ask me the vibrant quiescence of what, I have absolutely not a word, and I have absolutely not a concept of it. I can't produce a concept of it. That which was sensed, which came as a flash of realization, is something totally beyond my conceptualizing or verbalizing. But what is stated as a two-ness, chaos, cosmos, is a not-two-ness. Integrate them. That is to say, you can't integrate them, I can't integrate them. They are integrated in this one unitary wholeness, which is transcendence. You can use the word Brahman. You can use the Buddha's terminology, the unborn, the unbecome, the unmade. And his great affirmation, this tremendous power, which, if you realize, releases you from intellectual conflict, his great affirmation that were there not this unborn, unbecome, unmade, there would be no release out of the conditioning and the sorrow imposed by the become, the born, the become, the made. But why should or should not there be release from the born, the become, the made? Because in the release from the born and the become and the made, the release out of the becoming process, you do not stop the becoming process. But you have realized the complete unity, the completeness, the wholeness of total reality. Can you feel the extraordinary peace and the extraordinary freedom, this unshakable freedom of mind that the Buddha talked of, that would come to you then? When this happens, nirvana is manifest through you, through your becoming process, as long as you, the psychophysical organism, as the Tathagata on earth alive, moves. It's unimaginable. It is not to be believed merely. It is not something which we should strive to understand, because our striving is a disturbance, not a rhythmic vibration of that living reality. It is a disturbance. Our striving is a disturbance which obstructs nirvana, what we call nirvana, from manifesting through our samsara, our becoming process. If our becoming process from day to day and year to year is the perfect beauty, the perfect expression of that Ritta, that divine order which is inherent in all things, would it not be, let me use this word, a sin to prevent the becoming process of such unimaginable beauty, of such transcendent love and transcendent wisdom in actual manifestation? If you had the light of the world in your midst, would you run away, push him out outside, shut the doors? But alas, has not mankind done that through the ages? Remember the cry of Jesus, O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, which stonest the prophets. Now you see, why do you or I, Jerusalem, stone the prophets? Because we cling to this unbeautiful, this ugly samsara of ours. And we separate out a postulated nirvana, a postulated heaven outside us. Don't do it. Let it come into us. We do not realize, attain, achieve, obtain. Let go completely. Step out into the void fearlessly. the void of your own being, and you will find the fullness of your own being blossom out in that immeasurable, unimprisoning void. And this something, this eternal spirit within one, will be disimprisoned and soar through the total reality on wings of song. In the Zarathustrian scriptures, heaven is described as the place of song, Garodemana, the place where the divine song is continually sung. And it is a song which is a silent song, a silence and a stillness which holds the whole cosmic process and all the sound of the cosmos in it. But that sound is a sound of power, a sound of power which is creative energy in action all the time. And that is the meaning, one of the meanings at least, of hearing the voice of God, the still small voice which thousands of people call the voice of conscience. But conscience is your representative of God. It's the small voice which fills you, the microcosm. There is the great voice, the voice of God, the voice of totality which fills the macrocosm. And both voices are still and silent. But you can hear because you are quiet. You are empty. And in that quietness and emptiness, all this happens. When you hear that still and silent voice of the macrocosm, out goes the difference between vidya and avidya, between knowledge and non-knowledge, between ignorance and enlightenment, between dukkha and samasambodhi, between samsara and nirvana, between anatta and atta. In that one total reality containing all that you and I call the opposites, in that one total reality, because of that absolute containment, nothing is rejected, nothing is accepted, simply because it is the one total reality. In that one total reality, there is the eternity which in our poor language, we of necessity have to call it the peace that passes understanding, the Mahaprajna, the Mahakaruna, the Ananda, the bliss of God, and so forth. But in that eternal reality is also the destruction construction process simultaneously side by side. This creative activity in eternity is something altogether extraordinary. I said the other day, I think, that it is non-repetitive. Every pulse of creation is entirely new. I have to use the word rapidity, but it's the wrong word. There is no right word. I can't find the right word for it. This destruction creation takes place, this pulse of creation, with incredible rapidity. That is why our consciousness cannot keep pace with it. And we are aware of it in terms of what turns out to be a time lag. And that is why we are conscious and have the memory of a past. We are conscious of a present which is not the absolute, this is difficult, split moment, because now I'm using the language of time, now, and which has that anticipatory consciousness which we call a future. But this pulsation is of such a nature that this creation construction, this life-death pulse, where death is identical with other life, comes into being. And the two function like that. And chaos, cosmos are in timeless conjugation, just as samsara nirvana, dukkha sambodhi, avijja vidya, anatta and atta are in this state of timeless conjugation. Perhaps these are terrible words in a sense. Our little minds, our little hearts, craving for something for the self, cannot escape this little craving, this little poisonous worm, nibbling away at our inner being. But I say to you, let go. Let go completely. And you will lose nothing. You will gain nothing. And then you will be you will know freedom from the burden of gain and freedom from the misery of loss. There will be true freedom. And the reality, which is reality, call it material, call it spiritual, call it psychological, call it what you will, but these are all limiting terms. That freedom will be there. Manifest the divine freedom. Manifest through you, through me, the limited, finite mortal. What is the self running about to find? As I said, if there is, as you said, if there is no self. But no self is only one limited view. Self is another limited view. But this particular psychophysical organism, which for practical purposes we can call a self, has a purpose in existence. Because the limited self lives within the limited context. And wheresoever there is limitation, we can talk of a goal, we can talk of a purpose, we can talk of fulfillment and fruition, or we can talk of destruction and wastage. What is our context? Life for mankind, for the human species, as we become conscious of it, is something which produces change and growth and development. It shows certain trends of change and development and growth, till it comes to fruition in this species called man. What is it working towards? Man is distinguished from the other animals on this planet anyway by the fact that within him is this extraordinary thing called religiousness. This religiousness means this something which comes to awareness as to the meaning of individuality, the indivisibility of this organism itself, the thing we call the psychophysical organism, its indivisibility. To put it in another form, if one grows rightly, one realizes full and true egohood. Having come to that state in which body and psyche are both mature, they are an integrated whole. Having realized that state, there then emerges this other state, this religiousness still growing. You realize your relationship with not only your little environment, but with the total environment, the whole world, the whole universe, if you like. So that in mind and consciousness, at least, you are not separate from totality. You see, then this religiousness has come to fruition. And you realize that the self, this little self, has to cease. And in fact, if it does realize that it has ceased to obtrude itself upon its environment, then it is truly the Lord of creation. It has true dominion over all the other kingdoms of nature. Remember, to have dominion has no relationship to having domination or exercising domination. Dominus, the Lord, the Master, is the protector and the breadwinner, the sustenance winner. You are the sustenance winner for yourself, your fellow human beings, for mankind, for the animals and the birds and the flowers and the trees and the grass and everything. Therefore, physically, materially, it is our business to live ecologically, conserving the economy of nature, not dominating nature, not trying to master nature, to conquer nature. Devilish concept, devilish activity. You see? So, the little self is moving towards that. So that this trend of life, this will of the transcendent, if you like to put it in human language, the will of God, or the will of the unborn, the unbecome, unmade, is moving each little self, is drawing each little self towards such a fulfillment and such a consummation. But in the process of that fulfillment and consummation, all our little goals vanish. They all vanish. That sense of totality, of the one unitary wholeness, absolutely fills your being. There are no opposites anymore conflicting within you. For everyone, everything has its place. If there were no dukkha, would there be nirvana? Could there be nirvana? If there were no nirvana, just turn about and look in the opposite direction. If there were no nirvana, would there be any dukkha? And so forth. You see, let this sense of the one total reality, of the true meaning of transcendence, come to flower in your heart, in your mind, and in all the actions of your daily life. And that will spell the complete fulfillment and fruition of you, the man, the woman, living in this world.